Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former U.S. President Donald Trump is found liable on allegations of sexual battery.
Given all the cases that has been alleged, my initial reaction is that this is a tiny drop in the bucket of justice. But it's the right kind of drop.
The United Nations says Somali women and girls in displaced camps face gender-based violence and rape. A Somali journalist reflects on his time in prison. A Zimbabwean writer and filmmaker responds to her acquittal for alleged incitement of violence. We'll have analysis and the prospects for a civilian-led government in Sudan as Egypt's foreign minister meets South Sudan President Salva Kiir about the conflict in Sudan.
The effects that have been wide-reaching to both the immediate and most active neighbors necessitates that we consolidate our effort to contain this situation.
And a Malawian court orders the government to allow Rastafarian children to wear dreadlocks in class. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A jury in New York City has found former U.S. President Donald Trump liable for battery and defamation. The case was brought by E. Jean Carroll in November. She alleged that Trump defamed her in his Truth social media platform by calling her allegations a hoax and a lie. Carroll had alleged that Trump sexually assaulted her in 1996. The former president has denied the charge. ABC News reports that the jury awarded Carroll a total of $5 million. Kweku Nuama is a professor in the School of International Service at American University here in Washington, D.C. He tells me that the verdict is a tiny drop in the bucket of justice because it is the beginning of accountability for former President Trump.
Given all the cases that has been alleged, all the issues that are pending, my initial reaction is that this is a tiny drop in the bucket of justice, but it's the right kind of drop.
What do you mean it's the right kind of drop?
It's the right kind of drop because it is the beginning of accountability. It's the first time that he's been held accountable for many of these things, many of these allegations, and he simply brushes it aside. He doesn't even bother to explain. He simply says, it's not true. You know, I didn't do it. And his supporters believe him. And all these women that are accusing him have been called liars. So this is the first time that he's been held accountable. And as I said, it's a tiny drop in the bucket of justice, but it's the right kind of drop.
Of course, just to put it right, the former president denied the allegations by Ms. Carroll.
Yes. And a jury of his peers disagree with him. And they ruled that even though they don't have evidence to prove that he raped her, there's sufficient evidence to support a verdict of sexual battery and a defamation claim.
Can we put this in the context of, say, political leaders in Africa? What do you think this means?
Well, political leaders in Africa are not held responsible for all kinds of things that they do. They abuse people, they abuse the rights of their citizens, they violate all kinds of laws, and there's no accountability. So Donald Trump pretty much has been operating in a kind of a consequence-free environment that our leaders have. But this verdict is going to hurt him in some important ways, particularly in the general election. And I hope that Africans are paying attention to what's happening here and we learn from this kind of experience. This is not a political vendetta. It's not Joe Biden that's going after his predecessor, as we often see in Africa. This is the legal system operating the way it's supposed to operate. There is no interference of any sort. And if Africans allow our legal systems to work without political interference, we can get a verdict such as this.
Professor Kweku Nuama, thank you so much. A pleasure speaking with you.
It's great talking to you, James.
Kweku Nuama is a professor in the School of International Service at American University here in Washington, D.C. Egypt's foreign minister met with South Sudan President Salva Kiir in Juba on Tuesday to discuss how Cairo and Juba can help convince the two warring generals in neighboring Sudan to peacefully resolve their conflict. Egypt has taken in more than 70,000 refugees who fled Sudan since the violence began. April 15, Dino Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
Egyptian Foreign Affairs Minister Sameh Sokri paid a visit to Juba to deliver President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's letter to President Kiir, praising his efforts to mediate a ceasefire in Sudan. Sokri says the Sudanese violence has had far-reaching effects on South Sudan, Egypt, and other neighboring countries, and there is a need for a coordinated approach in dealing with the humanitarian crisis brought on by the fighting.
The effects that have been wide-reaching to both the neighbors, the immediate and most active neighbors in the relationship with Sudan, both Egypt and South Sudan, and necessitates that we consolidate our efforts and exchange views on the way forward to contain this situation and to relieve the difficulties that are being met by the Sudanese people, and to continue to impress upon the combatants the importance of a sustained ceasefire and the return to a political dialogue that can serve the best interests of Sudan at this critical juncture.
Sokri says the high number of refugees fleeing the violence is worrisome, adding that Egypt has already registered more than 70,000 refugees since the start of the conflict.
And we will continue to coordinate and to cooperate and to contribute to relieving this very critical situation and to deal with the humanitarian consequences that both Egypt and South Sudan have had to bear, related to the influx of a very large number of the Sudanese fleeing the conflict areas.
Several Sudanese experts have said Egypt has sided with the Sudan army, which is battling for control of the country with the rapid support forces. Sokri denies Egypt has played any role in the Sudan conflict. He insists the presence of Egyptian troops in parts of Sudan is legal.
The presence of Egypt in Marawi is similar to the presence of Egypt in various African brotherly countries on a very clear legal basis of the cooperation in one of the important sectors, which is defense and military capacity building. And any contention or speculation otherwise is malicious and unfounded and unnecessary, and can only fuel feelings of
South Sudan Acting Foreign Affairs Minister Deng Dao says Egypt and South Sudan share similar views on the conflict.
This is a very concern that any disintegration, any continuation of war in Sudan will put pressure on our countries, because we are very close neighbors to Sudan. And this is why all the efforts that are being done internationally, they have to be coordinated, they have to be merged, so that the beneficiaries in the end are the Sudanese people.
Both Juba and Cairo are calling on Sudan's warring parties to observe a declared ceasefire and embrace dialogue as the only viable way to bring about stability in Sudan. Sporadic fighting was reported on Monday in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
With no sign of progress at peace talks between Sudan's warring parties, analysts warn the conflict in Sudan could have grave consequences for the country's neighbors, as well as for hopes that Sudan can one day have a government led by civilians instead of the military. VOA's Africa correspondent Mariama Diallo has this report from Nairobi.
25 days since the war in Sudan broke out, there are no indications the warring factions have any intentions of negotiating an end as fighting rages on. Ravina Shamdasani, spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office, told VOA during a recent visit to Nairobi that the situation is troubling.
Yes, there are ceasefires. Yes, that has led to some reprieve, some calm, where people are able to actually leave their homes and try to flee. But airstrikes are continuing. The takeover of residential buildings for military purposes by the RSF is continuing. And even people who are trying to flee, on the way, they're facing not only security risks, but extortion. There's acute shortages of medicines, of food, of fuel. The situation is really rising to the level of a full-blown conflict.
The conflict has the potential to affect the whole region and beyond. Kweku Nwama, professor of international politics at American University in Washington, tells VOA.
Sudan has seven neighbors, all of whom have some degree of, you know, chronic instability. And so this conflict can go regional in a minute. And it can even spill over across the Red Sea into, you know, the Saudi Arabia, Yemen. So there's a whole bunch of things that can go wrong in the region.
Representatives from the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces have been meeting in the Saudi city of Jeddah. While the immediate need is to try to broker a truce and lay the groundwork for broader discussions, Susan Stigant, Africa director for the U.S. Institute of Peace, says there are concerns about Sudan getting back to a civilian-led government.
I think many people have expressed questions and concerns about the role of civilians and citizens and political leaders who will absolutely need to be at the center of discussions about any political future, and who are those who are really on the front lines right now responding to the humanitarian crisis inside of Sudan.
The head of the Rapid Support Forces, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti, said in a recent tweet post that he and the RSF are committed to democracy and the transition to a civilian-led government. The Gallo's counterpart in the army, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, had made no such pledge, though it's worth noting that the Gallo and Burhan cooperated to overthrow Sudan's joint civilian-military government in October 2021. The ongoing conflict has created an exodus to many neighboring countries, including South Sudan, where many left a few years ago when that country also experienced a civil war. Now some have been forced to come back, says Charlotte Hallquist, spokesperson for the UN Refugee Agency in South Sudan.
We have recorded almost 45,000 individuals that have crossed, but the numbers are likely much higher than that. So it's this ultimate tragedy of a second displacement. So they fled their country during the civil war. They sought safety in Sudan and are now fleeing back to South Sudan.
She said many have spent long days on the road, walking, taking the bus, or using donkey carts to cross the border into Upper Nile State in South Sudan. They are arriving exhausted and hungry, says Hallquist. The refugee agency is providing emergency relief at the border and transporting people to the town of Rank. But Rank has limited resources, she says, and the agency is encouraging people to move on from there. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 10th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Somali humanitarian workers and United Nations officials said women and girls in displaced camps are facing gender-based violence and rape amid the recurrent droughts in the country. Physical violence, intimidated partner violence, or IPV, and rape are the most common types of violence that women and girls are subjected to in displaced communities, according to data gathered by the United Nations Population Fund. UNPA Assistant Country Representative Bassan Ahmed Sayi tells viewers Harun Maruf that women and girls in displaced camps are the main victims of the gender-based violence.
The state of abuse is really enormous. Many people describe Somalia the worst place women to live, and this is because of specific vulnerabilities Somalia women have. As you know, there was recurrent drought, 4-year consecutive failure of rains that has displaced a huge population. It has affected almost 7.7 million population. In other ways, the total IDPs of Somalia is estimated around 2 million, which shows our women and girls have specific vulnerabilities because of the shelter they live in. Usually they live in a shelter that's kind of makeshift, a shelter that's made up of plastic papers, which any perpetrator can come in easily. And because of the scarcity of resources, families are stressed, and that brings a lot of problems among families. And this also shows that there is also high incidences of physical violence.
And this data that you just mentioned, when was it, which time, which period was it?
The data I'm referring to is the year 22 between October, November and December.
Throughout Somalia?
Yes, in Somalia. Our reports also show increase of violence by 4%.
Okay, so 4% increase of violence against women compared to when? As opposed to when?
Compared to the last compared to the third quarter of 2022.
And are these abuses widespread? How concerning are they to you?
Well, we could say it is happening everywhere in Somalia, both in host communities, both in IDP situations. So it is really a worrying situation that we need to take action by relevant authorities and relevant concerned groups.
And tell me about your personal reflection on these abuses. How does it affect you as a woman and as a professional care provider to these victims, survivors?
Yes, it is true that when you're really involved in this dealing with survivors and working with survivors, and I don't directly work with survivors, it is really stressing, and sometimes you feel helpless. Sometimes you feel you really need to do extra, you need to work hard to help the situation. What worries me most is that how people think that it is something propaganda or something that does not exist or something just talked about by women advocates.
Bassan Ackman Sayi is the assistant country representative of the United Nations Population Fund. She was speaking with Haroon Maru for VOA Somali Language Service. Zimbabwe writer and filmmaker T.C. Dangaremba says her acquittal by the country's high court proves that the conviction was a miscarriage of justice. A Harare magistrate's court found her guilty in 2020 for holding up a sign demanding institutional reform. The government said then that she was demonstrating without permission and indicted her for incitement to violence. But an appeals court on Monday this week acquitted her of the charge. T.C. tells me that she is encouraged that the High Court shows respect for the laws of Zimbabwe, but she cautions that there appears to be a tendency of the magistrate court in Zimbabwe and the ruling ZANU-PF to weaponize the law.
It's been more than 2.5 years of my life in which I have been persecuted for an action that was well within my rights as a citizen. And I feel it was most unfortunate that the magistrate's court and the police would have taken that route. However, the police did say that they had received a telephone call telling them to go and arrest us. I do not know who that telephone call came from.
You said that the magistrate court and ZANU-PF, which is the ruling Zimbabwe party, continue to weaponize the law. What exactly do you mean?
I mean that the ZANU-PF party, which presides over government in Zimbabwe, has influence over those courts in order to use the courts as a weapon with which to intimidate and punish people who the ZANU-PF organization or various individuals in the ZANU-PF organization feel are a threat to ZANU-PF's total grip on all sources of power in Zimbabwe.
You are encouraging Zimbabweans to behave peacefully. At the same time, there are those who will say that even a peaceful demonstration is met by arrest by the police. How do you reconcile these two?
I do believe that it is true to say peaceful demonstrations can be seen as criminal by the police and people may be arrested. I was demonstrating peacefully with my colleague when I was arrested. Seven other people, including Fadzai Mahere, who is the speaker of the largest opposition group, the Citizens Coalition for Change, known as CCC, was also arrested when she demonstrated peacefully with her companions. I know of other people who demonstrated peacefully on that day who were arrested by the police. And so the problem is manifold. And in each case, it is a problem to do with the behavior of certain arms of state. In the case of arrests, the problem is with the police, who are an arm of the state. The problem with prolonged persecutions and unjust verdicts is with the lower court, the magistrate's court. I hope that the High Court will continue to observe the letter and spirit of Zimbabwean law as it is codified.
That was Zimbabwe writer and filmmaker Tsitsi Dangarembga. She was speaking with us from Stockholm, Sweden. The High Court in Malawi has ordered the government to start allowing Rastafarian students to wear dreadlocks to enroll in all public schools. The verdict marks the end of a three-year legal battle in which two Rastafarian learners sued the government over its requirement that students cut their hair to promote uniformity in school. However, the court said Monday this week that the policy is unconstitutional. Lamek Masina reports from Zumba, Malawi.
The judgment follows a judicial review application by two minors who in 2020 were barred from enrolling in public schools for wearing dreadlocks. Lawyers for the students said the policy, which the Ministry of Education used to deny the children access, was unlawful and infringed on their right to education. In his judgment Monday, Judge Zwone Ntaba ordered the government to abolish legislation passed in 2012 which denies dreadlocked children from enrollment in public schools. Chikonde Chijozi is the lawyer representing the children.
What it means is that all Rastafarian children who want to be enrolled in a government school, whether primary or secondary or tertiary education, they cannot be denied admission at the school based on the fact that they cannot cut off their dreadlocks.
Malawi's Rastafarians have long been sidelined by the Ministry of Education policy requiring students to cut their hair. In response, many parents choose private schools, while others give in and adhere to government policy. Ali McRoy Nansolo is a member of Rastafarian movement in Malawi. Nansolo, who also wears dreadlocks, is among parents who send their children to private schools.
So it really affects us because as a parent myself, we have a high expectation to our children. And when they grow up, they'll be teachers, they'll be lawyers, they'll be what. But to reach this destination, they have to go pass through education. Now, being denied the right to education, it was very painful.
However, 3 months ago, Attorney General Jakaka Nyirenda requested presiding Judge Ntaba to stop hearing the case by asserting that Malawi has no policy against dreadlocks and that government schools were banning the students of their own accord. Judge Ntaba rejected the request. In her decision, Ntaba ordered the Ministry of Education to inform all public schools by June 30 that no student should be denied entry into classrooms because of dreadlocks.
If government doesn't comply, there are procedures that are followed under the law where there's non-compliance of a court order when we get there, which I hope will not.
Malawi's Minister of Education said Tuesday that it will fully comply with the court's judgment, a statement which has pleased Rastafarians. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta, Malawi.
And that's it for this Wednesday, May 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton, Washington, wishing that you will have a very good Wednesday.